Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fregal Barron. Every week I speak to leading sustainability thinkers and practitioners, scientists, economists, NGOs, business leaders and investors. We discuss the sustainability imperative, the key challenges, the latest thinking, and what's working in sustainability, resilience and regeneration. I'm very pleased today to welcome Thomas Lovejoy back to the podcast. Dr. Lovejoy is a tropical biologist and conservation biologist, and known as the godfather of biodiversity. He's a senior fellow at the United Nations Foundation and university professor in the Environmental Science and Policy Department at George Mason University. Dr. Lovejoy was the World Bank's chief biodiversity advisor and the lead specialist for environment for Latin America and the Caribbean, as well as senior advisor to the president of the United Nations Foundation. He serves on many scientific and conservation boards and advisory groups and is the author of numerous articles and books. Well, so thank you very much, Thomas, for taking the time to speak to me again for the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
Always happy to do it.
Great. So how are things with you since we last spoke? What are you working on at the moment? One of the things I'd really like to talk to you about is your new book, but maybe you've just set the context a little bit.
So I think what I'm really mostly focused on now is a two-point agenda, both pieces of which are sort of intertwined. There is, as always, my ongoing efforts on behalf of conserving the Amazon and making sure that it continues to work as the system that it does. But the other part of it is looking at the global picture of biodiversity and climate change, not only their interactions in a negative kind of way, but also what ecosystem restoration could do to get us a better outcome for both.
Great, great. So that's, in fact, the topic of I think your most recent book, or which you've edited and contributed a number of pieces, Biodiversity and Climate Change, which I guess is situated in the context of what you call climate change biology. Can you talk a little bit about what climate change biology is and why you focus on biodiversity and climate change together? Why it's important to think about them together?
Well, they're basically two very interrelated reasons. One is that because all life is built of carbon, when we basically destroy and degrade ecosystems, we are simultaneously impacting biological diversity and releasing a lot of carbon to the atmosphere. And the carbon in the atmosphere becomes part of human-driven climate change, which then comes right back and affects biological diversity where it currently occurs, upsetting delicate relationships, changing the climate envelope in places so that some species, in fact, can no longer survive where they have for literally millennia. So it's one great big Gordian knot of environmental challenge.
Yeah, and how well established is it, the connection between biodiversity and climate change and biodiversity? I know there's increasingly, we hear a lot of talk about the terrible goings on with deforestation and the impact of deforestation, certainly, but more broadly, have these ideas been thought about in a joined up way, or have they been isolated? And maybe just set the scene a little bit.
So I would say that anybody who is knowledgeable about nature and conservation will know that there's not a place on this planet where you don't see the impact of climate change on biological diversity, changing essentially the annual calendar of species, changing where they occur, and in certain instances, getting to the point where some ecosystems are beginning to fall apart.
Yes, yes. And in terms of the research and in terms of the domains where people study these questions, how well established is the study of them, looking at them together and look at the interrelatedness of them?
So it's an exploding field because basically anybody who's trying to do natural resource management or conservation or is just, you know, a lay person enjoying some time in nature will know that things are changing all over the place. And it also has the additional element, of course, because of elevated CO2 in the atmosphere, and that some of the CO2 absorbed by the oceans actually turns the oceans more acidic. So that is affecting biological communities and coastal zones and elsewhere around the world.
Yes, absolutely. Now, in the book, you talk about some estimates of the carbon consequences, I guess, of ecosystem destruction and so forth. Can you talk about that? It's quite shocking, the actual scale. And has this been something, again, just setting the scene a little bit, how well established and understood has that been?
So it has always been known that you destroy a forest, you release a lot of carbon to the atmosphere. But only in January 2018 did we get really precise figures on the extent of it, which included not only just simple removal of a natural ecosystem, but also degradation. And the figures that came out were quite shocking in one sense, in that the amount of carbon in the atmosphere from destroyed and degraded ecosystems is literally equal to what remains in extant ecosystems. So it's a huge number.
Yes,
and
yes.
Buried in it is actually potentially good news, which if we do extensive ecosystem restoration, which we would want to do for lots of reasons, because ecosystems benefit us directly through services and other contributions sort of all over the planet, we would get essentially restoration of those benefits at the same time as drawing down some of the CO2 load in the atmosphere and reducing the amount of climate change that we will have to undergo.
Right. The whole question of drawdown is very interesting, and the question of, some of the figures that you use, I guess, in the book were something like, these are just estimates, but it gives some sense of this kind of scale, reducing it by a one part per million being about something like 8 gigatons. Is that something like that?
Yeah, so I want to go back and check those numbers, but basically what we know about it says that tens of parts per million of CO2 can come out of the atmosphere, and we can thereby avoid the equivalent amount of increase in global temperature.
Yes, yes. So can you maybe just talk about what is ecosystem restoration or ecosystem restoration, and where are we in terms of where the main areas of potential do you think to really have an impact with this?
Well, I mean, first of all, there's large portions of the tropics where restoring natural forest would give you huge biodiversity benefits, but also better watersheds and those kinds of services. But basically, we have really run down and degraded a lot of ecosystems on our planet. The amount of degraded agricultural land in the planet is a huge number. I don't have it in my head, but it's a huge number. And if you restore that and you move to agricultural systems that accumulate carbon, you actually get increased soil fertility as opposed to leaking carbon, which are most of modern industrial agriculture does. Same is true with degraded grasslands and grazing lands and coastal wetlands are another part of all of this, mangroves in particular, which you should want to do anyway because of how they benefit fisheries and protect against storm surge. So while we're not talking about reforesting London or Manhattan, we are talking about restoring ecosystems quite broadly across the globe.
Yes, yes. And how, as we say, popular are these ideas? To what extent? I mean, it seems like a very good idea, and particularly when you put it side by side with some of the other alternatives which are being, I guess, considered in some areas in geoengineering and related kind of ideas. So is there some momentum on this? What do you think? Where do you think some of the more interesting examples are?
So interestingly enough, one of the three conventions that came out of the Earth Summit in Rio in 1992 has always been about that, which is the UN Convention on Desertification. It's all about degraded agricultural lands and restoring them to, you know, be functional and productive. And when you do that, they actually accumulate carbon in the process. The other parts of it are newer, but reforestation has always sort of been on the agenda, but not prominently in climate change. And the other parts of it, particularly the coastal wetlands, have gotten a lot more attention as sea level rise begins to be a serious issue for coastal communities.
Yes. Do you see this changing?
I think so.
What are some of the drivers there? Some of the just because I guess when it comes to something like drawdown or taking CO2 out of the atmosphere, any project which has kind of financial returns and so forth is always going to be attractive, I guess. What are some of the obstacles do you see to ecosystem restoration?
So I think the major obstacles are basically insufficient awareness of its potential so far. But I think we're going to see at the Climate Action Summit at the UN in September that this will have a very conspicuous role and a conspicuous place.
Yes, yes. And what are the governance? I mean, you mentioned the Rio platform with around desertification. Have we got the kind of governance, the appropriate governance to start to look at these issues in a global way? Or what have you some thoughts on how that's structured and how one would need to think about that to really make some change?
So I think we have some pieces like the desertification convention. And there was a Bonn agreement about reforestation some years ago. But those are only part of the potential. So basically, it's something that needs to be done in almost every country. We don't actually have a lot of governance for that at the moment. And in a way, I would love for this to just sort of take off before there was a lot of governance, because it would then, I think, drive better governance. And one of the things that's so wonderful about it is that it takes climate change as something that most people see as so overwhelming. How could they possibly make a difference? to something where every individual can make a difference by helping plant a tree or help restore a local wetland or whatever it might be. So I think the potential here for public engagement is a huge positive.
Yes. I saw some technology-related innovations here using drones to plant trees. Very promising, high impact. But yes, it's something that I guess that we can all be involved in. I'm interested in the question of, because primary forests clearly have a significantly greater impact in terms of the carbon they actually hold and so forth. Is there a danger that, how are we doing in terms of, dealing with deforestation of primary forests?
So it's a mixed picture, and basically speaking, tropical forests are still in retreat.
Yeah,
it varies from place to place. But a number of the countries that have suffered this kind of problem actually included reforestation as part of their commitments at the Paris Climate Agreement. So it had already begun to creep in a little bit. Now we need to take it to scale.
Right. And I guess there's a tension here, underlying tension in terms of use of land for ecosystem restoration and use of land for the land that belongs to indigenous peoples and then the land also that's being used to feed people. Can you talk a little bit about some of the tensions there?
So when it comes to land that are part of indigenous peoples' lands, basically, they tend to be positive players. They are some of the best stewards of ecosystems on the planet. The tougher one is the food and land use trajectory. But we actually know scientifically that we can feed all the coming billions an adequate diet without destroying another square inch of nature. And that means improving productivity in some places, cutting food waste, which is like 40% of all food is wasted. And it's also changing our diets in the way that our doctors are telling us to do anyway. Less beef and lamb and things of that sort, more fish and chicken, and wonderful vegetarian options as well.
Yes, it's taken some time for change. Do you feel some momentum there? Certainly there are quite a bit of innovation in the alternative meat or meat substitutes. Do you see in America, they like their beef, they like their steak?
Well, one of our major fast food outlets is introducing a veggie burger.
Right.
So that tells you something. I mean, their estimate of their market says that they think this might work, right?
Well, yes. One of the bakers in the UK has had some great success with a artificial vegan sausage roll. It's broken sales records. So clearly, there is some demand there. And can you talk about what is ecosystem-based adaptation, and is that an important idea?
So ecosystem-based adaptation is from a conservation perspective, it's doing conservation design so that species can actually move from one elevation to another or from one location to another. They're already on the move. It's just that in many places they are in isolated fragments of natural habitat, and being able to disperse across landscapes that are not particularly biodiversity friendly is a big issue. So one of the things we need to do is put connections back between natural areas so that the plant and animal species can try and track the conditions that they require.
Right. And is this something that's developing now, becoming more important?
Certainly in the conservation community, you hear it talked about all the time.
Yeah, because I guess it's a question that people are talking about now, whether there's been enough attention focused on adaptation rather than mitigation. And another area that I thought was quite interesting is it called green-gray adaptation. Can you talk a little bit about that, and do you think that's got potential?
Yeah, so basically, first of all, we're at a point where we don't have a choice. We have to do adaptation as well as mitigation. I think what you're referring to in the green-gray is it's looking at problems of storm surge, for example, on a coast. And the old-fashioned approach would have been to create a seawall. That's gray infrastructure. Green infrastructure could well be, if it's a tropical place, restoring mangroves, because they're very effective against storm surge. And one of the really interesting things about sort of the green kinds of infrastructure protecting against flooding or storm surge is that what those habitats actually do is they break up the energy in the storm surge. Whereas a gray infrastructure, just a seawall, doesn't reduce the energy in the least. It just passes it on laterally, and it will do damage wherever it ends up.
Yes. I mean, how optimistic are you in general, Thomas? They say it was in addition to the 1 degree we've already seen, that there's already another 0.6 of a degree, as it were, baked in already in terms of the CO2 already emitted. And the IPCC and such like tend to be a little bit backward looking, tend to be a bit out of date, as it were. How optimistic are you that we're doing here?
So, you know, if you look at the numbers right now, you wouldn't be optimistic. Particularly when you look at the essentially resistant behavior of the fossil fuel companies and certain governments which deny climate change. But we also know societies can change very rapidly. And what I think I'm finding very exciting is the number of young voices that are now involved. And in the end, I think they become far more powerful than they themselves might actually realize. Because when young people are basically sort of calling the older people to account because it's their future that's being affected, it can carry a lot of weight.
Yes, I mean, we've had the recent surge of attention with Greta Thunberg and we've had Extinction Rebellion, which is, I guess, very active in the UK at least, and a lot more attention to climate change. Is there a danger of spending, the Green New Deal in America getting more attention, whether it turns into policy or not, and in the UK as well? What's at stake, or is there danger of not taking into account biodiversity? I mean, in a sense, you know, you just wonder how much space there is in public awareness for a range of different issues. Certainly the climate change has got considerable momentum now. Is there danger of just focusing on climate change and excluding biodiversity, or not giving it the importance that it needs?
Well, that would be just a grave error, because basically the planet works as a combined biological and physical system, and if we ignore that, we really set up future generations for a pretty miserable existence.
Yes, yes. And do you feel that biodiversity is getting the attention?
Well, I think the recent UN assessment that came out a couple of weeks ago actually got a lot of attention. And one can fault the Biodiversity Convention for not having created a scientific body until 2012. But having put out that report, I think it got front and center attention around the world.
And you think that that'll get turned into policy and action?
Without any question. So, I mean, I was talking to the Deputy Secretary General of the UN on Friday morning, and it will definitely be part of the Climate Action Summit in September.
Great, great. And finally, I guess, what about timings on this? Because, you know, every month that we don't take action, we're getting, you know, behind. And the windows are closing as well, I guess, and there's, you know, tipping points that we're going to hit. Are there, in your mind, some key timing constraints and things that we need to think about?
So, basically, we don't have a minute to lose. And the sooner the world realizes that we have to actually truly pivot in how we're managing the planet, the better it will be. And, you know, you look at the current trends and you couldn't imagine that happening. But societies are able to actually, you know, pass social tipping points where it's suddenly something that has been sort of on the sidelines for a long time becomes center focus.
Yes, I guess the elephant in the room maybe to some extent is the focus, the economy, and the focus on economic growth. And they seem like small figures. They always seem like small figures, but compounded, you know, if economies want to grow by a couple of percent a year or 3%, aspire to do that over 20-25 years, you're talking about a doubling in the size of the global economy. Do you see that as consistent? You know, do you see that as underlying, you know, just major issue?
So, you know, I think economics can create solutions as well as also, you know, be a system which ignores societal decisions. I think we're going to find some really creative economic solutions coming along, and one of them actually will be trying to incorporate the value of ecosystems on a daily basis into the way economic decisions are made.
Right, so that's getting rid of this, I mean, I guess integrating, getting the so-called externalities and bringing them into the way we value and economic decisions.
Yeah, so we no longer can afford to treat the way the world actually works as an externality.
Yes, yes. What's next for you, Thomas?
Well, what's next for me? well, a lot of work on the Amazon coming up. Interesting National Geographic focus on the Amazon, both in the magazine, but in some of its grants and an expedition. Trying to highlight how the Amazon actually works as a system. So I'm pretty excited about that. And beyond that, at the moment, I've just got my head above water, having gotten through commencement and finals and grading papers. So I haven't actually fleshed out the rest of the agenda, but I know it's all here and heaping piles on this desk.
Well, I wish you the very best of success with your ongoing work, Thomas, and thank you once again for sharing your insights today on the sustainability agenda.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for paying attention to these critical things.
Great. Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. It would be great if you could leave a review and share the podcast on social media. You can sign up at iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.